Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
This morning, I'll be reading from Matthew 8, verses 5 through 13. Matthew 8, verses 5 through 13. Now when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, Assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. And I say to you that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness, and there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, Go your way, and as you have believed, and so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour.
It is good to see everyone here this morning. We live in a wonderful place where weeks like this one, it can go from 30 degrees to 70 degrees in the same day. And so my sinuses are still recovering from that. If I sound a little funny this morning, that's my excuse. I don't have an excuse any other Sunday, but this morning I have an excuse for sounding funny. I hope you'll bear with that. But as we have been going through this month, we've been looking at what it means to be in Him. And specifically this month, we're thinking about having joy in Him. And so from Philippians chapter 4 and verse 4, we've taken kind of a theme verse for this month. If you would, let's say it together. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. And as we've been going through Philippians on Sunday evenings, we've been reminded of the power of joy in rejoicing even in difficult times. What is it that amazes you? We've been going through a study of the King of Kings in the book of Matthew, and we've come to Matthew chapter 8. Now, because of the nature of this series, we're not going to be able to stop in every chapter along the way. But when we get to Matthew chapter 8, the term amazing is used. What is it that amazes you? Amazing is one of those words that is used maybe so often that it kind of loses some of its meaning. Sort of like the word awesome. Everything is sort of amazing, and this is amazing, and that is amazing. But just think for a moment about what it really takes to amaze us. In fact, in 1915, Alexander Graham Bell made a phone call to Thomas Watson from New York all the way to San Francisco. There was a huge crowd to see what would have happened. This was clearer to go from one side of the continent to the other than even the very first phone conversations had been. It was incredible. People were reporting it in the newspaper. It was amazing. But I have a feeling that most of us in the room this morning would have a cell phone, and if we called somebody in California, the person next to you probably wouldn't be all that impressed. It's just sort of part of our daily life now. It's not all that amazing. In July of 1969, America watched as man stepped foot on the moon. What an incredible achievement, a result of mission after mission after mission. They got closer and closer. And you've seen the pictures of the big control room in NASA with all the huge computers. And yet, if we think about smartphones that we carry around or laptops that we have, the technology we have with us on a daily basis is better than anything that was in that control room. And that sent a man to the moon. Those sorts of computers were once very impressive. We might consider it amazing, but we're not as amazed by that anymore. Just a few days ago, the comic book character Superman celebrated his 80th birthday. 80 years of Superman. Years ago, when they first started developing these serial productions of Superman's adventures that would be shown a lot of times before movies in the theater, you would have Superman be in a scene, something was happening, and he had to go, and he would run and jump off camera, and then you would just hear that he was, you know, flying, the sound effects that he was flying, and then it would cut to, you know, the just Superman's head and his, you know, arms as he's flying through the air. Looking back on it now, it doesn't seem that amazing. Because a few years later, when Christopher Reeves became Superman on the big screen, you had this idea that he could really fly, and look at the special effects. And now it seems like every movie that comes out has effects that are mind-blowing, that just 10 years ago, sometimes even 5 years ago, those special effects would have been shocking to us, would have been amazing, but it's not that easy to amaze us anymore. Because we're used to things like that. So there's a sense in which it's hard to really amaze us. But there's another sense in which we can be amazed by things we're very familiar with. Picture what it's like to be in a scenic place. Maybe for you, one of your favorite places to be is on the beach, looking out over the water. Maybe you prefer being in the Smoky Mountains, wherever it is, and watching a sunset and seeing the display of colors as they cast shadows over the landscape all around you. You've seen it before. It's not a surprise. You know what's going to happen. But isn't it still amazing? Aren't we amazed by just the intrinsic nature of what's taking place? Or maybe a moment where you stop and look around a dinner table at Thanksgiving or at Christmas as family members are passing plates to one another and are telling old stories and are laughing. You knew it was going to happen. It's not a surprise. You're not shocked by what's taking place. But haven't we taken moments where we've stepped back and just been amazed at the beauty of people who love each other being together? It's that kind of intrinsic amazement, just stepping back and soaking up what's happening, that we see in Matthew chapter 8. And so as we think about the term amazing, Jesus here responds to a man's faith as being amazing. Now, it's important for us to think about the context that we come to these miracles in Matthew chapter 8, specifically the one that Caleb read for us. Not too long ago, we did a series all the way through the Sermon on the Mount. And so even though we were in Matthew chapter 4 last week, we're not going to spend time in chapters 5 through 7, although that's an incredibly powerful section because we did that not too long ago. But I would remind us that in chapter 5, Jesus says something that would have been incredibly shocking as he's preaching the Sermon on the Mount. He says that the righteousness of his listeners needs to exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. In fact, I would venture to say that's the key statement in the Sermon on the Mount. That's his thesis statement. And as he goes through, he describes how that kind of faith, the faith that he's calling them to, leads to a greater righteousness than the scribes and the Pharisees. And then we get to chapter 8, and he encounters a centurion, and he marvels at the centurion's faith. Keep in mind, if this is a Roman centurion, that theoretically would have been over 100 soldiers. That's where that term comes from. We don't know how many technically he had under his command at this time, stationed in Capernaum. But he had some authority. He had some leadership here. But also significant is that he isn't a Jew. He's a centurion that works for, that serves the military of the occupying power. And so Jesus looks at the faith of a Gentile and is astonished. It's worth noting that comes right after the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus has just talked about what we're looking for, and then he sees faith at which he marvels. And if you look at Matthew chapters 8 and 9, you have 10 of the 20 miracles that are in all of Matthew's gospel concentrated in these two chapters. Jesus is following up teachings with miracles to drive home what he has been preaching. That is, he is here to call people to a new righteousness. So what does it take to have a faith that amazes Jesus, that would cause Jesus to stop and to marvel at someone's faith? Well, I think there are a few things we can see from the passage that we just read that maybe if we could incorporate those into our lives, we could develop this kind of faith the centurion had. It's always interesting that in the Gospels, when centurions are referred to, they're all referred to in a positive way. Centurions stand out as pretty good examples of how to live in many different aspects of the Gospels. But notice what happens as this one comes to Jesus. First of all, faith that is displayed by the centurion understands what God can do. He understood what Jesus could do. In fact, he knew the kind of power that Jesus had. Now, it's interesting as he makes this statement to Jesus. He comes to him and says in verse 6, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home." The term for servant could also, in certain contexts, mean son. And so it's sort of led to some people asking, well, wait a minute, is this his servant or his son? Historians tell us that centurions weren't allowed to have family during their military service, that they weren't allowed to marry in the time they were conscripted to serve. And so it may be that this is a servant that's very close to him. It's not uncommon in the ancient world for people to consider their servants as part of their extended family. Whoever it is, this is someone that matters to this centurion. And he comes to Jesus and he says he's lying paralyzed at home. And based on what we read in Luke, this man also had a good rapport with the Jews in his area. He had built them a synagogue. And so we get a sense that this is someone who has the kind of attitude that would be open to coming to this Jewish teacher who'd been performing miracles and asking him to help. Now, if you flip back a few chapters in Matthew chapter 4, here's what we see Jesus doing in verse 23. Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness among the people. The news about him spread throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all who were ill, those suffering with various diseases and pains, demoniacs, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. Large crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis and Jerusalem and Judea and from beyond the Jordan. This means that not only were the people following Jesus those from Judea, but the Decapolis, the 10 cities, was a Gentile region. So word was spreading, not just among the Jews, but also among the Gentiles, that Jesus could do miracles. Among other things, he could heal those who are paralyzed. And so this man knows what Jesus can do. If I want to have the kind of faith that is modeled here by this centurion, I have to begin by knowing what God can do, knowing what Jesus can do in my life. Whose voice am I listening to? Whose power am I relying on? You see, it's very easy to live life as if I'm in charge and I need to handle everything, that I'm the one who's got to take care of anything that comes up. We're kind of used to that. That's the way we function. It's the way we operate. And yet this centurion, who is a powerful man, who had a great deal of authority, understands that there's something that needs to be done that he can't accomplish. That his influence, that his ability, that the men he commands, they can't stop what's happening here. There are some things only God can help us with. Only the power of God can provide for. Do I understand what God can do? Maybe there are times I look at situations in life and say, you know, there's really no way this will ever change. Do I understand what God can do? There's no way this person is ever going to become a Christian. I can tell you, I've known them a long time. I've grown up with them. I've seen the decisions they've made. There's no way that their life would ever change. Well, do I understand what God can do? You know, I'll never be able to do this. I'll never be able to teach a class. I could never go on a mission trip. I could never be the kind of parent that I know that I should be. Well, do I know what God can do? It's worth pausing to reflect, whose power am I relying on? Because faith understands that there are things that only God can do. And the more I spend my time trying to handle things my way, the more frustrated I'm going to be. Faith understands what God can do. But faith also understands who we are. To me, this is one of the most fascinating things about this passage, is that a powerful centurion would come to a traveling teacher who was making Capernaum his home base, but was traveling around different places, and reach out beyond his status as a centurion, used to being the one who gives orders, being the one who tells people what to do, and comes up to him and says, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, fearfully tormented." Jesus says, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion said, "Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed." What would it be like for a centurion to look at Jesus and to say, I'm not even worthy for you to come under my roof? This is a contrast between what the Pharisees would often do. The Pharisees looked at Jesus and the people he was with and said, hey, they aren't worthy to come eat with us. The centurion looks at Jesus and says, I'm not worthy for you to come to my home. He may have been referring to the facts that Roman centurions would have known. That Jews did not spend time in the homes of Gentiles. They had a division there. So maybe he's, a bit of this is that he's being kind, that he's realizing that fact. But I think there's something larger here. I think there's an idea of an inherent humility that's coming across from this centurion. I'm not even worthy for you to come to my home. When I understand who God is, that there are some things only God can do, I'm going to understand myself a lot better. And we've mentioned before what happens when people come into contact with God. So in Isaiah chapter 6, when he has this vision of the throne room, and he hears, holy, 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 and he looks and sees this image of God on his throne, he immediately says to himself, woe to me. I am a man of unclean lips, from a people of unclean lips. Isaiah was a prophet who was used to calling out woes on other people. But when we get to chapter 6, he says, woe is me. Why did he say that? Because he saw God. Or in the first chapter of the book of Revelation, when John encounters Jesus, this incredibly vivid depiction of Jesus, and he falls down as if dead. When confronted with the power of God, he understood who he was. If I struggle with humility, it may be that I haven't spent enough time reflecting on who God is and who I am in relation to Him. That doesn't mean we're down on ourselves or that somehow aren't happy with ourselves and what we're doing. It just means if I understand who God is, then I understand how unworthy I am for what God has given me. And so I need to ask myself if I really know who I am. You see, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus spent a lot of time talking about how people wanted others to see them a certain way, and how Pharisees would stand on the street corners and pray to be seen by men. And they would make sure that when they were fasting, everybody knew they were fasting. They looked a certain way. People would look at them and say, wow, I can't believe, boy, they really must be dedicated to God. And when they were giving, they wanted everyone to know how much they were giving, and they wanted to make it loud and make it a big scene. And as Jesus talks about that, he describes that kind of adulation, that kind of reception of others as their reward in full. Jesus is focused on who we really are. And so it's a striking contrast between the hypocrites that Jesus is describing in the Sermon on the Mount and the centurion that comes to Jesus and says, I'm not even worthy for you to come into my house. Faith understands who we are. And faith also understands how authority works. Now, this was an individual, the centurion, who was used to authority. In fact, his entire life, his everyday routine, would have been typified by authority. And you even see it in the way he describes his life to Jesus. He says in verse 9, for I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and he does it. The centurion tells Jesus, I understand how authority works. I know what it's like to get the orders, and I know what it's like to give the orders. And you're powerful enough, all you would have to do is give the orders. Now, it's interesting when he talks to Jesus, he describes himself as one who is also under authority. It's interesting to us because we might ask the question, well, why would he say that to Jesus? Why would he talk about being under authority with Jesus? And yet, how many times do we read Jesus in his ministry saying, I'm here to do the will of the one who sent me. I'm here to do the works of my Father. That if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And so it's not just that Jesus is the Son of God, that in his mission, he's reflecting this mission given to him by the Father, but also Jesus has authority and possesses authority. And so the centurion's able to say, you know, I understand how authority works, and I know that you have the kind of power, you don't even have to come to my home. You can say something, and just simply saying it will cause it to be true. Authority is usually seen as a negative thing today. It's usually seen as one of those words we like to avoid because we just don't like authority. And at the same time, if I want to understand faith, if I truly want to know my relationship with God, I'm going to need to understand authority. It's interesting to think about the kind of life you would have lived under Roman rule. Caesar may have had the total authority. The one on the throne might have had total authority, but it was delegated to someone else. And there were probably times when even the servants of one of these military leaders would go to another military leader. And maybe he would walk up to him, and he might be 20 years younger. But if he was speaking the words of the commanding officer, it carried authority. If he was speaking the words of the one who was really in charge, his message carried authority. It wasn't because of the servant, it was because of the one who sent him. I think there's some significant parallels in that for us. There'll be several of us today that will teach a Bible class, that'll stand up in front of others. Even when someone stands here to preach to you, God's word has authority. What we're thinking about faith today, what we're reading about faith, has authority. But it's not because of me. It's not because of whoever's standing up here. It's not because of some sort of intrinsic knowledge or wisdom or whatever else. We're just relaying the message of the one who has true authority. It's not because of the speaker any more than the messenger of a general that's taking word to soldiers who are older than them. It's not because that messenger has that kind of gravitas where they really say, wow, he's got authority. They know the message has authority. If I want to understand faith, I've got to know how authority works. I've got to know that when I make decisions in my life that they aren't just up to me. It would be nice if everything were up to me. It would be nice if I could make all the choices that I want to make, and yet, that probably wouldn't get me where I think it would. I'd probably end up in a place very different than what my goal would be. It's a blessing to live under the authority of God. It's a blessing to know the kind of life that's going to lead to eternity with Him. It's a blessing to know that I'm not just out here on my own, that I have authority, that I have someone whom I can serve. It's a real blessing. Faith understands who God is, His power. It understands who we are. And it understands how authority works. It's not something we should resist. If we live lives under God's authority, we'll be blessed. There are some things that can amaze us. I don't know what it is for you that you're amazed by. One of the things that has always struck me, and maybe it's because I'm not crazy about heights, is when you watch someone who is a trapeze artist, who's able to swing and to do all these flips in the air and is able to go from one to the other and grab onto a trapeze and keep swinging. That's amazing to me. One element of that that I think is maybe the most amazing is the moment when someone has to let go of one swinging trapeze in order to get to the other one. You can't get to it unless you let go. If you hold on to where you are, you're never going to get over here. They have to trust what they've been doing, trust their training, and let go in order to reach something else. It's easy for us to try to hold on to control of our lives. To try to be the ones we want to be in control. I imagine that for this centurion, it was not easy to admit to himself that there was something he couldn't handle. Any more than it's easier for us to admit, you know, there's something we can't handle. There are some things that we have a hard time with. And yet, it's important for us to be willing to let go of that control we've held on to in our own lives and hold on to God. If I want to have a faith that's going to last, I'm going to need to do that. You know, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7, people were amazed, people were astonished, because Jesus taught as one who had authority. He could say, you've heard it said, but I say to you, when I submit to that kind of authority, I can have the kind of faith in Matthew chapter 8. If I understand chapter 7, I can live out what we read in chapter 8. It may be that you need to submit to His authority this morning. It may be that you need to become a child of God, that you need to turn your life around and to put Christ on in baptism. You can do that. It also may be that you need forgiveness, that you need prayers, that you need encouragement. If you'd like to pray with a couple of our elders, you can go right out this door after our service, and a couple of them will pray with you and for you in the conference room. Or it may be that you want all of us to put our arms around you and to pray for you here. If there's any way we can help you, please let us know as we stand and as we sing together.